Good morning, everybody. I couldn't close this. It's an honor to be able to address you. You know, 25 days, we'll be celebrating Hanukkah. So if you stopped 100 Jews on the street and you did a free association test, you know, that's where I say a word and you have to tell me the first thing that comes into your mind. So if I said Rava, you'd say Abaya. That's a good example of a free association test. Of course, if you said who, we're in big trouble here. So if I said Hanukkah, Hanukkah, what's the first thing that comes to your head? All right, what do you think the first thing that will come to the head of somebody who wasn't trying to make a joke? So the first thing that comes to your head would be Judah Maccabee, maybe menorah, candles, Beis HaMikdash, a few things like that. If I ask you to say, tell us the story of Hanukkah, you would probably tell a story like, well, there was this Greeks and they were stopping the Jews from worshiping Hashem, and then Judah Maccabee rebelled against them, and then he threw them out, and took over Yerushalayim, took over the Beis HaMikdash, and it was all Tomei, and he found a little bit of oil, put it in the menorah, lasted 8 days, and that's the story. So we have Hanukkah. So none of that is incorrect, but that would be sort of like me celebrating the Dolphins' victory on a particular game when they lost the season and lost the Super Bowl. Like, who cares? They won that game. Our knowledge of Hanukkah, and particularly when I say our, I don't mean those of you that are sitting here. I'm talking about the Jews in general. Their knowledge of Hanukkah has been adulterated terribly by a terrible, terrible Jew by the name of Gratz, who lived in the end of the 1700s, who was the father of the Reform movement in Germany. He wrote a Jewish history book. And the book is, you think Trump has a problem with fake news. That book is fake history from beginning to the end. And he creates the story of Hanukkah as a military victory for independence of the Jewish people. And yeah, they were happy to get their temple back, and you know, maybe there was a miracle, maybe not. That's his story. That's the average, that's certainly what non-religious Jews believe if they even heard of Hanukkah, but that fake piece of history has infiltrated every one of us here. So let me tell you what really happened. I'll give you the short story first. About a year after Judah Maccabee takes over Yerushalayim, he gets killed in a battle. The Jews lose Yerushalayim to the Greeks again. And the civil war between the Jews and the Greeks goes on for 25 more years. We didn't win a battle. We won one little battle. We didn't win the war. We lost Yerushalayim. The Greeks took it over again. They were bringing pigs on the Mizbeach as a form of sacrifice. Only 25 years later were we able to get rid of the Greeks, and we were only able to do it because we brought the Romans in to help us. And we all know how that ended. 100 years later, 150 years later, you have the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. So what is really the story of Hanukkah? Certainly not that one victory. So to help you give a little bit of context here, I'm going to give you a 3-minute lesson in Jewish history that if you remember what I'm about to tell you over the next 2 to 3 minutes, you will have no problem with Jewish history after that. We don't teach much Jewish history in the yeshivas. First of all, like I asked Rabbi Grumblatt that question once, and he said, well, we don't really have anybody who knows it to teach. Very honest answer. And even if we did, we probably would teach it wrong, would give you names and dates and places. You'd have to memorize lists, and you'd forget it like you forget world history and American history. And it's a shame, because if you know Jewish history, you have no choice but to be a mamon in Hashem. You cannot deny that Hashem is taking care of us if you just know a little bit about Jewish history. So let's go back 3,332 years ago to the year 2448. That's when the Bnei Yisrael went out of Mitzrayim. 2,448. It's easy to remember because 2 times 24 is 48. So 2448. Now, everybody knows they were in the desert for 40 years. That's easy. Then they came to Eretz Canaan. The Mishkan was 14 years in Gilgal. They moved it to Shiloh for 369 years. That's easy to remember, 369. 369 years. They were then, the Mizbeach and the Aron were separated in different places for 57 years. They then built the first Beis HaMikdash. Shlomo HaMelech built the first Beis HaMikdash. How long did the first Beis HaMikdash last? 410 years. Everybody knows that. We were in Golus for 70 years. Everybody knows that. Then we came back. The Anshe Knesset HaGdola with Ezra, with Mordechai, all that under the auspices of the Persians. They let us come back after 70 years, as was predicted by the prophets. And we built the second Beis HaMikdash. Second Beis HaMikdash lasted 420 years. We all know when the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, 70 AD, which means the second Beis HaMikdash was built in 350 BC. So from 350 BC to 70 AD, we have the second Beis HaMikdash. So now you have the key dates for the first half of Jewish history, post-Churban, until now is the second half of Jewish history. So let's focus a minute in that period of the second Beis HaMikdash. The beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash starts with the Anshe Knesset HaGdola, under the auspices of the Persians. We did not have political independence in Eretz Yisrael at that time. We have not had political independence in Eretz Yisrael and the area surrounding Yerushalayim and Judah since near the end of the Churban of the first Beis HaMikdash. What we have today in Eretz Yisrael, which is a country run by Jews, defended by a Jewish army, has not occurred for 2,500 years. So, the Anshe Knesset HaGdola, the Sanhedrin, is running the country under the auspices of the Persians. We're paying the Persians taxes. We're a colony of Persia. That works out real well. Then one day, the Anshe Knesset HaGdola, at the end of its phase, was taken over by Shimon HaTzadik, who was a Kohen Gadol. Shimon HaTzadik was one of the great leaders of Judaism. 40 years he ran. He was Kohen Gadol for 40 years. When he was a child, he was sent out. When I say child, probably a bar mitzvah bocher. In that era, he was sent out by his grandfather, who was a Kohen Gadol, to represent the Jewish people when Alexander the Great passed through Eretz Yisrael. And when he passed through Eretz Yisrael, Alexander the Great, who you may have heard of, in fact, he asked Shimon HaTzadik, who was a young man at the time, but representing the Jewish people, asked him, why didn't you sign the peace treaty? When I sent you the peace treaty, why didn't you sign with it the first? He says, well, when you sent it to us, the king of Persia was still alive. We had promised the king of Persia we would never rebel against him. We keep our word. We are a people of gratitude. And now that you've killed the king of Persia, the promise is no longer there. We'll pledge loyalty to you. So Alexander the Great only was interested in taxes. He had taken over the whole world from India all the way through the coast of Spain and North Africa. He wanted just taxes. So he says to the Jewish people, what do you want? He says, we don't want anything, just one thing. Let us live according to the Torah and let us have our own independent judicial system and Beis Din so that we can serve Hashem. So Alexander the Great says, that's terrific, no problem. He gives him full authority to do that. And in return for that, many Jewish children are now named Alexander or Sender. It's not a Jewish name. It's a non-Jewish name. But out of appreciation to Alexander the Great. Is anybody in this room named Alex? Okay, it's not so popular now. These things come and go. So it was good. The country was growing. It was economically stable under Alexander the Great. Shortly thereafter, he dies. We're talking now early 300s AD, BC. His empire splits up into four empires, as was, it's explicit in the psukim in Sefer Daniel. In fact, they came to him and showed him Sefer Daniel and said, it says here in Daniel that a Greek is going to take over Persia. So he was very impressed with that. The whole world was very impressed with the Torah. In a minute, you'll see how. And when he died, his kingdom broke up into four kingdoms. One, the two that we need to know about is the Greeks in Egypt, and the second is the Greeks in Syria. And they were always fighting each other. And Eretz Yisrael was in the middle of these fights. But they were only fighting Eretz Yisrael for taxes. First the Syrians would come, then the Egyptians would come, and all they wanted was money, taxes. They could do whatever you want, worship any god you want, do whatever you want, plant what you want in your farm, just send the taxes to us. It's about money. So, this battle goes back and forth, and at some point in time, some anti-religious Jews in Eretz Yisrael are able to convince the various Greek parties, either in Egypt or in Syria, that they should collect the taxes on their behalf. And they bought the taxes. This group of people is referred to in the Gemara as the Muhsin, the tax collectors. They cared only one thing about money. The people were religious. The people had loyalty only to the Sanhedrin, to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, but there were these group of Jews within Eretz Yisrael that wanted power. And in order to consolidate the power, they invited in the Syrian Greeks, invited the army in, and said, if you come in with your army and you go after the Sanhedrin, you go after the practice of God's Torah in Eretz Yisrael, stop it from happening, we will give you a lot of money. So the Greeks are in business for cash. They don't care. I mean, the Greeks all over the world didn't care what God you served. They never persecuted people for religious reasons. Only in Eretz Yisrael they got sucked into this deal because of the Muhsin, who were Jewish. Traitors to our people. And they started to prohibit the practice of our religion. No bris milah. They started bringing, in every city they would build a mizbeach and they would sacrifice a pig on the mizbeach. By the way, what I'm telling you now is not just in the Gemara. It's not in the Gemara. It's in a book called Sefer HaChashmonaim, which is not part of Tanakh, but was written by the Jewish people at the end of the Chashmonoi War. It is considered a legitimate piece of history. It's quoted by Josephus throughout and brought throughout all the legitimate Jewish histories for him that are written by Talmidei Chachamim. It's a little bit of a slant on the way Josephus writes it, but that's not for now. So it was a terrible situation. Now, why in the world would these Mochsen, who only cared about making money, want to stop their brethren, the Jewish people, from serving Hashem? And the answer to that question is because they wanted to adopt Greek culture. They felt that Greek culture was superior to the Torah culture. It was an advancement in what mankind should behave like, and they wanted to enforce their will. That's what progress is. Progress is when the other guy makes you do something that you don't want to do. So the Mochsim are now called the Misyavnim, Jews who have adopted Greek culture. Now, if I told you what Greek culture was like, you would laugh. They used to have Olympics. Everybody was nude in the Olympics. No busha, no tznias. They had multiple gods that they would worship, and each of the gods were fighting each other. It's like comic book superheroes. Imagine a religion where all your gods are comic book superheroes. I mean, maybe you read comic books, maybe you watch superhero movies, I don't know. But you don't take it seriously, do you? They took it seriously. That's how stupid they were. And they really believed it. And the Greek culture was an advancement of the Persian culture. And the Persian culture was an advancement of the Babylonian culture, which was very cruel. We don't understand it from that perspective because we view the world through Torah glasses. So we're waiting for the rest of the world to catch up to us. But that's what the Greek culture was. And they stopped us from having bris milah, from keeping Shabbos, from marriages. They were serving up pigs on a mizbeach all over the country. So one day, the representatives of the Greek army and these Misyavnim, who were Jews, who caused this trouble, they're bringing up a pig on a mizbeach in a city called Modin. And a man by the name of Matisyahu, who was a Kohen Gadol, he just got enraged. He himself, and he was 64 years old at the time, he himself kills the people involved in bringing up the sacrifice and calls on his sons to revolt. We can take it if you want to take our money. We can take it if you're going to give us a hard time with our farming. And you're going to... They took 10,000 slaves a few years before that from the Jewish people to sell. We can tolerate a lot, but there's a line. The one thing we will not tolerate is if you tell us we cannot serve Hashem and follow the mitzvahs and learn Torah. That was the cause for the revolution. And they had a revolution, and they fought the Greeks. And yes, they did beat the Greeks in a lot of early battles. And yes, they did take over Yerushalayim briefly. But then, as I told you before, the war continued for another 25 years after. But when they came up to Yerushalayim, and they decided to, they had to get rid of the old Mizbeach because it had Avodah Zarah on it. They were nignas, as the Gemara says, to see until Mashiach will come to find out what the psak is. What do you do with it? They built a new one. They had no oil. They found the oil. It burned for 8 days. Why was that so important? Because during the period of time of the Anshe Knesset HaGdol and Shimon HaTzadik, there was the miracle of the western lamp of the menorah burned for 24 hours. Every other lamp in the menorah, the other seven lights, burnt out when the oil ran out. But the western one stayed for 24 hours. My wife has a lamp like that also. The wick is not working too well, so it lasts the whole Shabbos. But this one was working well, and it lasted. It was a nace. And how do you think the people felt when they saw that Hashem had not abandoned them, and Hashem was endorsing their fight for the right to serve Him? It inspired the people so much that they were willing to continue to go through another 25 years of war and revolution and have to bring the Romans in, all for the only purpose of being able to learn Torah and do mitzvos. So I'd like to ask you a question. That's the story of Hanukkah. The story of Hanukkah is about our willingness to die, our willingness to fight and die for one reason only, and that is, of course, we fight for self-defense, but the reason we're willing to rebel when our lives are not threatened is when you threaten my ability to serve Hashem. Now, let me ask you a question. The average human being on this planet would say the following: look, God, you want me to serve you? I'm ready to serve you. You want to make it so hard? Don't make it so hard on me. What are they coming after me for? They want to kill me. They don't want me to serve you. All right, I'm ready to serve you. But you don't want me to serve you, obviously. You're putting all these obstacles in my way. It's the argument you guys tell yourselves. This Gemara is so hard. If you really wanted me to learn Gemara, why don't you make it easy? Right? You really don't want me to, because you would make it easy if you really want. You wouldn't do this to us. You wouldn't make our life miserable if we were trying to serve you. It's a valid argument. So why did the majority of the Jewish people reject that argument and say, no, we're going to fight the Greeks, and we're going to fight the Misyavnim, and we're going to serve Hashem and learn Torah, irrespective of the fact that it might get us killed? Why would they do that? Obviously, so many obstacles. Let it go already. So in order to understand the answer to that question, and that is really the essence of what we do, the answer, I'm going to give you a mushroom. If somebody walked into this room right now and said, I'll bet you $1,000 Rashi never existed, I think everybody in this room would take the bet. Now, you never met Rashi. Why are you so sure Rashi existed? Well, you say, well, look, he had to exist. First of all, you can go to France and there's a city there called Troyes, and there's a statue of Rashi that the French government put up. We know he lived here. We know he learned in the yeshiva in Worms. We have his writings. We know his grandchildren, the Rivam, the Rashbam, Rabbeinu Tam. It's impossible. I didn't meet him, but of course he lived. We have so many footprints of Rashi's life that there's no question. But how do you know? How do you know you didn't see him? And assuming you can believe what you see, how do you know? So the answer is the collective knowledge of the people denies any argument to the contrary. Yes, you yourself might not have met him, but my father was in the Worms Beis Medrash after World War II in the Holocaust. He went there, visited, he had a picture on his wall of Rashi's Beis Medrash in Worms. How do you know it was really his? You just track it back. Millions of people do not accept something based on the fact that millions of people know it. A million people could say, oh, it's true because one guy saw it and we want to believe him. But here we all saw it. It just got passed on. It's our collective knowledge. 1,000 years ago is not so long. That's when Rashi lived. Well, at the time that the Hashmonaim were fighting, they were just a few hundred years away from the first Beis HaMikdash. 500 years away from Dovid HaMelech. From Nevi, 300 years away from Yeshaya and Yirmiyahu HaNavi. The reality of Matan Torah was as real to them as the reality of Rashi is to you today. And Matan Torah, every single Jew, through a gift of God, experienced prophecy, Nevuah. Moshe didn't hear it, and then he came and told us about it. We heard Hashem. We were not roy for Nevuah, but Hashem gave the entire nation that experience. We heard Nevuah. It came into our head, whatever that means, and we knew for a fact that Hashem was telling us the Torah and telling us to observe the Torah and keep the mitzvos and telling us that he is with us forever and we are his people to carry that message throughout history, nobody had a doubt. Nobody. And that experience was as alive to the Jewish people in the times of the early times of the second Beis Hamikdash as Rashi is to you today. So when the Misyavnim said, we don't want you to serve God, the reaction was not, well, look, don't make it so hard. If you really want me to serve you, God, I'll do it. But how can I serve you if it's so hard? The reaction was, you can't take that away from me. That's mine. I own it. You cannot tell me not to do this. This is mine. This is my identity. It's not a job I'm supposed to do. It's not a function I'm supposed to come to yeshiva and learn. I'm supposed to come to school. I'm supposed to put my tefillin on. I'm supposed to keep Shabbos. It's your identity. It's who you are. It's not something you're supposed to do. If it's too hard, I can't do it. You can't take that away. That's who I am. The Misyavnim, by trying to promote Greek culture, were committing ancient identity theft. You can't take who I am away. My grandfather, my great-grandfather, stood at Har Sinai. He didn't witness an event. He heard Hashem through Nevuah. And now you want me to abandon that? I can't abandon that. That's who I am. If I can't do that, I'd rather die. You can take my tax money. You can take my fields. You can enslave my family and sell them all over the world. But you want to take my identity away? I don't exist anymore. I'm ready to die for that. Because the experience of Matan Torah and the miracles in the first Beis Hamikdash were as fresh to them as your personal experiences are to you. That's what Hanukkah is about. The rest of the world will spend the rest of your life trying to convince you there is something better out there. The Misyavnim have not gone away. There are many people within the Jewish people who will try to convince you that there's superior aspects to life besides Torah culture. Torah culture is primitive. Yeah, of course, modern culture is very sophisticated. Just ask the German Jews in 1930 about... In 1930, if you wanted to be a doctor, you had to go to Germany, because the high point of human knowledge in 1930 were the German medical schools and the German philosophy schools. And Germany was the high point of the world. Look what happened within 10 years. You will spend the rest of your life wondering, is there something better out there? Does outside culture have anything to offer me? And the answer to that question is, how could anything on the outside be superior to the experience of Matan Torah and hearing Hashem directly? You heard it directly. What more do you need? Now, you might say, well, I don't remember. I don't know. But the collective knowledge of our people is telling a story that the entire nation heard it. And it's so fresh, and it's so true, and it's such a fact that to deny it is to essentially exist in a world where you are out of touch with reality. The rest of the world will continue to promote its culture. Now, the world is a better place than it was 1,000 years ago. Every aspect of it that's better came directly from Torah. And it will be better 100 years from now than it is now, because they will incorporate more of Torah philosophy into Western culture, because that is the path that Western culture is moving to. But it is our job, and we have to be willing to die for this job, it is our job to stand and say, we represent what Hashem wants. How do you know? Because I was at Har Sinai. I remember once I had a professor, and he asked me a question. He wasn't religious, he was Jewish. He asked me a question. He said, how do you know that what you're doing is right? So I looked him in the eye and I said, my father told me. And he looked at me and he said, I wish I had a father like that. Thank you.